So this is sort of it's work related to trying to understand quantum mechanics as an epistemic theory. So I'm just going to start immediately with how strange Bohm's theory is and why it's not perhaps the most why it's not the I don't think it's the the ideal theory. And then I'm just going to introduce the motivation why to look at so-called psi epistemic theories. So so let's first look at classical mechanics. So I had pictured this to be much more informal. Now it's in the Bob room and I'm getting recorded. So everything I say can be held against me. But please ask questions. I just want to keep it, a very informal blackboard talk. So in classical mechanics, we have pairs of variables, and there could be many of them. And in addition to that, we have some probability distribution. So if this is phase space, and we can consider that we do some experiment where we know that the initial configuration is somewhere here in phase space, and the experiment makes the probability distribution split up into two, then of course there's this variable, which is time dependent, which goes to one of them, and there's the probability distribution which goes to both of them. Nobody's concerned with that there's this branching probability distribution because it's not supposed to represent anything in reality except, for example, our knowledge of the situation. It would be fantastic if we could represent quantum theory like that, so that the wave function just represents some knowledge of something, but it's not reality itself. So of course, here we have some more structure. We have Hamilton's equations of motion, Q, H, and also this Liouville equation for the probability distribution. In Bohm theory, we have the same structure, basically, of the theory. It's just a collection of variables, Q. They are subject to some laws. They evolve. And then we have the wave function on the configuration space. So, well, so in this case, we have a Hamiltonian. And that Hamiltonian generates a vector field. This vector field here on phase space. So in the Bohmian case, it's very similar. We have the wave function, and that generates a velocity field. So we could imagine we have the same scenario here. We have the begin here. The wave function is localized around here, and then it branches up into, for example, two different superpositions for macroscopically distinct states. The only difference in Bohm theory now is that also this guy evolves according to a certain law like that, and the wave function is subject to the Schrödinger dynamics, of course. It would have been nice if the wave function is now just the probability on this space, but that's not the case because the wave function actually guides the particles. So in this case here, if you have two different probability distributions, you will have the same velocity field, irrespective of the probability distribution. In this case here, two different wave functions give rise to two different velocity fields on configuration space. And this is an indication that this is not, it does not represent the probability distribution on configuration space. A second thing is that the probability distribution on this space need not even be psi squared. It need not have anything to do with psi. So typically in equilibrium we would have, so this is the equilibrium distribution in Bohm's theory. It would be something like this, the psi squared distribution. But that's only the equilibrium distribution. So, well, I'm just saying something very simple here. It really doesn't need an argument in this audience. So psi is not a probability distribution. And it cannot be understood as such. Then that raises the question, well, so let us also just sketch here how you understand the world. How you, for example, if I'm given the variables Q, let me call this correspondence principle. This correspondence or so in any theory, if you're giving the basic variables, there should be one way of saying, well, if the variables are such and such, this is how the world looks like. This is, you know, representing a can over there, particle over here, etc. In Bohm theory, you have a pair of variables, pair of dynamical variables, and then you simply postulate that the wave function has absolutely nothing to do with appearances. Now, if we were in this situation here, where the pair of variables would be the phase space point and the probability distribution, to say that this has nothing to do with how the world looks like is very natural, because this is just a probability distribution, somebody's knowledge or whatever. But this is not the case in Bohm theory. This is not representing knowledge of somebody or some probability distribution.
You mean by the X?
Exactly. Yeah, here. So this is a strange rule in Bohm theory.
I see. So it's unnatural for the X on the right hand side, but it's rather natural for the X.
Exactly. So so when we want to say, you know, here's my variables, how do you now say what they correspond to? Where are things? Where are pens? And so on, whatever might be in our system. To take out these variables, saying that that has of course nothing to do with appearances. It's very natural here, but here it's very unnatural. And it's been long an argument. I don't know where this argument dates back to. Maybe David Deutsch. First one arguing like that, he was saying that this is a real quantity in Bohm theory, and you have simply no reason to say that this has nothing to do with how the world appears like.
So the kind of paradox you set up is the fact that, you know, the wave function doesn't have anything to do with appearances, but at the same time it guides the particles around.
Yeah.
And that's the tension. But so you could make a similar argument with the Hamiltonian in classical mechanics. I mean, there's nothing to do with appearances.
Sure.
But still it guides the particles around.
Sure.
But that's not considered paradoxical at all.
No. So I have to say also, if I would, you know, debate this with Anthony Valentini, I'm not sure I would, you know, be winning the argument. I think this is a nice argument. This is one of the things I'm happy with Bohm theory. So this is what I can say. If you look at the literature, people are trying all kinds of justifications here. For example, Shelley Goldstein, that theory, they say that this is law. But then this is some kind of very new type of law, right? It's subject to its own dynamics, it's time dependent, etc. Anthony Valentini says it's an interaction agent. So it's sort of a holistic, non-local interaction agent. Bohm and Hiley says it's active or inactive information depending on, you know, if this guy happens to be, active information is the thing that which is close to the Bohmian configuration. That, to me, all these different kinds of ways of talking about it really suggest that people are really a bit uncomfortable with this thing. And, and also, there's the functionalist argument. If you have an entity in the theory, you know, which behaves in a certain way, process information and so on, why shouldn't it give rise to, you know, conscious beings or whatever? But this is a bit too, this is very too philosophical for my thought today.
Shame.
What?
Shame.
So the task, which would be interesting to see if it's possible or not, is to see maybe quantum mechanics can be put in such a format as in classical mechanics. So here's the big grand question. Can we find some, and I'm going to use Rob's terminology, ontic variables, lambda. So the lambdas would be variables like that, for example, something which describes what's out there, independent of observation and so on. In Bohm theory would be something like that, or maybe even a pair. Can we find some ontic variables, lambda, so that the wave function just so this is the question. Can we find some ontic variables, lambda, so that the wave function represents just some probability distribution? So the idea would be that we have some ontic state space, we can call it big lambda. And in every moment, just a point here is realized. So this is the actual state of affairs. And the wave function induces a probability distribution on this space. So the ontic, this name ontic variable is probably the best name I'm starting to be convinced of. It's been called hidden variables before, which is a very it's a lousy terminology because, for example, in Bohm theory, the hidden variables are tables and chairs, the thing you have in front of you. So it's then John Bell came up with a term beable, but then people are, I don't know, that didn't catch on very well, except in the Bohmian community.
Sensitive the other way. That is, the wave function is on a configuration space, which is on the original configuration space, which is presumably not the space of lambdas. Why, given that, should we get probability distribution on the space of lambdas? And it shouldn't go the other way. If you're given probability distribution on the space of lambdas, we can compute wave function.
Yeah. So there's a question here, and this is a very good question. Give me some probability distribution on this space. Does that correspond to some wave function? Yes or no? And in fact, you can prove that at least in the case of deterministic theories, I think you can send the proof to indeterministic ones as well. The answer is no here. So at most, what you can get here is that the wave function describes some equilibrium distribution on such a space here. So in the case of deterministic fields,
Could the lambdas include the configuration variables or not? So, I mean, I would think that at least one large class of hidden variable theories would say have a big configuration space, which is a space of lambdas and x's. And the fourth ontic theory gives you probability distributions on lambda and x, so from which you average out and get probability distributions on x.
What's x now? The positions or?
The positions.
Okay,
whatever size the function of.
The task is here to find such variables. That's the task. It could be very strange stuff. It could be matrices, operators.
But is the following rule that? I mean, is the following rule that what the ontic theory gives me, use your term, what I can do with the ontic theory is posit an ordinary probability distribution on the joint configuration space of lambdas and x's. And from that, perform some coarse graining or averaging of the lambdas to get a probability distribution for the x's.
Well, the x's would be part of the lambda. Yeah. So lambda is understood to be all those things that are occupied.
For me, I like the writing of John Bell a lot. So the only requirement in the end I would like to see for these lambdas is that there's a mapping from a specific lambda, so that in ordinary typical situations, there's an image of the macroscopic world. So what do I mean by that? In classical mechanics, these variables, Q and P, how do I form the image of the macroscopic world? Well, I would look, for example, at the positions here. These are n triplets of real numbers. So I just plot those. So let me call Q looks like this, x1 to xn. And then I just plot that in physical space. And for example, I get a needle pointing like that. This is the mathematical procedure I'm doing in this theory to know where tables and chairs are. And so it's a precise operation I'm doing to see what it represents. Because mathematically it's quite an abstract thing, it's just a long list of real numbers. And then I'm told to group them in a certain way into triplets, and then I'm supposed to plot that in a three-dimensional space. Now, there's supposed to be some mapping here as well to some, to some picture, or maybe it's a table, I don't know what it is. I'm supposed to be able to, in typical situations, get an image of the microscopic world.
Lee was asking for a specific kind of map where your lambda space would be a product of your normal configuration space with something else.
Yeah.
And and the way to get out of the wave function would be by averaging over that with something else. So he was asking if that particular way of doing it would be more there.
So you have some
wave function, but
so there's sort of particles in the theory, that's what you're saying. For example, okay, so my lambda would be a person list here, and then there would be the question mark one, question mark two variables here, whatever it might be. And then I would say, if you'd like to know where tables and chairs are, you should probably look at those variables, if they are positions of something. So.
Sorry, just to fit, you're also implying, I guess, that the lambdas have some sort of law of evolution or some equations of motion associated with them.
Yeah,
so that's independent of size.
That's what I think is the most easiest way to go about. That might be false, and it could be in the end that the only thing you should think about is whole histories. So rather than, having a mapping to an instant, you want to, what?
Yes.
Yeah.
Are you going to add a caveat to that question? Because as stated now, the answer is yes, because I could just choose capital lambda to be projective Hilbert space, and the probability distribution would be delta functions.
Yeah.
Are you going to say, such that two wave functions that are distinct correspond to overlapping probability distributions or something?
I would also require something like that there's a mapping. If I just take the wave function, I'm going to have the same problem all over again that you have branching. And I'll be getting into the many worlds direction. I know that you think a little bit differently about it. You don't think having one theory for the whole system, including observers and everything. I like to think it in terms of that way, that it should be universal theory. And
I'm happy to have that. It just seems to me that this question doesn't get at the issue that you're trying to address, which is whether the wave function is epistemic or not. Because the probability distribution could always just be a delta function, and then the distinction between epistemic and ontic breaks down.
But what's your map M?
So what are you saying? So so you're saying I take the wave function as my ontic variable?
Yeah.
Yeah, but if you do that, then take that wave function for a system and apparatus together.
The point is that the question you've written down doesn't capture this distinction you're trying to get at.
This is also, I should say, this is heuristics only. So this is, so I'm going to get more refined later. But in fact, now. So this is Rob Spackins. This is the. An attempt to say what an ontological model is. So it's basically certain requirements. There should exist ontic variables. And some ontic state space. Set of possible preparations that these preparations, it's a curly P, I don't know if you'll be able to distinguish that from other P's, but that should induce some probability distribution on that state space. Right now it's just open. What are the possible preparations? Well, an ontological model comes with a precise mathematical specification what these things are, what possible preparations I can have in theory. Specify exactly and mathematically what possible measurements I can do in the theory. And I should have an indicator function. I'm just going to sketch it. So the indicator function, that's a variable which take the ontic state as an argument, what kind of measurement I'm doing. And this has, you have to specify all, exactly what you need to specify. You will have a lot of different things, what color of grids you have or whatever, all the things here in principle. And then it will tell me what the probabilities of getting a certain outcome. Oh, here, so this is math cal, So for example, in a deterministic model, this thing would be equal to 0 or 1. So the probabilistic prediction should take exactly this form. So here's the probability distribution, and here's the indicator function. So it's useful to look at the Broglie-Bohm theory as an ontological model. So I think there might be different ways of looking at these ontological models. For me, they represent absolutely no restriction on what kind of theory you're looking at, except perhaps that probably not. Maybe Raphael, maybe Yolanda, if they're whole histories, maybe one should rethink some things here. But in the framework of, you know, something evolving in time, I think this is completely general.
So you also need presumably some that tells you how to update the ontic state after a transformation.
That's true. So
dynamics or measurement transformation?
What do you call it? Dynamics or measurement transformation is your choice, but nevertheless, whatever you call it.
Yeah. So let me invent one such rule now here. So if you have such a mapping in the theory, then suppose the whole configuration started here. There is a probability distribution. You don't know which, and because of your measurement system and apparatus together. So this guy describes both system and apparatus. The whole thing is forced either here or here. You can generalize to the more possible outcomes. Here's just two different outcomes. So you start with a probability distribution, localized like that. It splits up with some weights here, you know, x percent here, and 1 minus x percent there. Then the updating would simply be that I know I'm here, so I'm somewhere in here, basically. So I would just cancel that one. So it would. One rule to do this was sort of to update according to what macro state in the end I'm ending up with. But now I'm just inventing.
I think you can just make it so that it's a stochastic map or whatever on
the
underlying ontic states.
But also, in the end, it won't matter, right? Because if I'm successful now, and the theory is really epistemic, this is a probability distribution. So there will be absolutely no consequences in the future if I update it in one or another way, because the system is going to do its own thing anyway.
When you try to build epistemic models, I think one of the real stumbling points is...
Yeah, we're going to come back probably to this.
...is to account for transformations.
But does the word measurement, I mean, how are we supposed to understand this at this stage? What does a measurement mean?
Oh, I mean, it's exactly like in Newtonian mechanics. It's,
But don't you have to have a notion of a variable, something that you're, I mean, what plays the role of an operator?
This is way too early. But let's go into the Brown-Bohm theory, because then we can talk about operators, because the theory is about operators. Here, this is so general. This is just, you can fit any theory into this almost.
I mean, yeah. So to clarify, these M's and P's are usually meant to be operational notions of preparation, like lists of instructions and things to do in the lab.
But to know whether something is a preparation rather than a measurement, doesn't one have to have some sort of notion of what the dynamics mean, theory?
I mean, really what you have is you have boxes which have inputs and outputs. So the system comes in, the system goes out, and you also have a measurement outcome. And that one type of box is performing all three different types of roles. It's a preparation, it's a measurement device, and also a transformation device. It's just a matter of how you speak.
So it's always useful to look how the Brown-Bohm theory fits into certain frameworks. The ontic variables here is the pair, or I call the Q over here. Yeah, I just call it X. It's the same thing. It's the pair, the positions of our particles, or maybe this is in the field theory, and it's exact fields. And also the wave function or wave functional, depending on what context. So,
So here comes possible. Possible preparations. So I'm going to prepare the system with a certain wave function. So this picks up the delta function here, telling that this is just peaked around a certain value of psi here. And then I have the equilibrium distributions here. Of course, Anthony has been stressing quite some time now that this is not all the possible preparations in Bohm theory, theoretically possible. Rather, because we have happened to find ourselves in a quantum equilibrium world, this turns out to be effectively possible. I just wanted to mention that.
I'm still a bit puzzled here, because on one side you're talking about boxes and input and outputs and so on, and on the other side you're talking about wave functions. And the wave function is actually, in a sense, the hidden part of the Borelli-Bohm theory.
Sure.
So how is one supposed to understand this on a generic basis?
What do you mean? Can I just go through it, and we'll be discussing that afterwards, because I'm sure there's going to be questions along the way. So in this, here I just have to put something here. There's so many different things I can do, but here I can say that the measurement is a von Neumann measurement, for example. So that would be some momentum of some different needles. So for each projector, for example, here I have a needle telling the outcome 0 or 1. And there's some coupling, fine varying coupling constants. Normally I would put them 0, put them equal to some value, and then put them 0 after what again. Again, here in the Broad-Bohm theory, this is not always the possible measurements I can do. Anthony developed this new notion, theoretically possible measurements in the Broad-Bohm theory, which he calls subquantum measurements. Yeah. So that's a very much more richer notion of measurements you have in the Broad-Bohm theory. But again, because we have found ourselves in a quantum equilibrium world, we cannot perform such measurements. Yeah. The indicator function. Some outcome, some measurement of some operator A. Here's some implementation. So here would be, let me see if you ask questions or not. Here I'm putting in new M, that's the local expectation value in Bohm theory. So that's defined as the real value of this quantity. So this is called the local expectation value, and
So what I do is the following. I take my specific measurement. I evolve my wave function. So I get some wave function at some later time. I could also plug in the time t here. I do the same with the Bohmian configuration. I evolve it. And that's also going to depend on what kind of measurements I'm doing, because that's the influence of the wave function, which depends on my measurement again. And then you can show that if I just evaluate this, I'll get one of the eigenvalues. So this is an outcome mapping that what outcome do I get if I do a certain measurement and have a certain initial condition in Bohm theory. So this is a very convenient expression to use, just to plug in like that. Probabilistic predictions, so that's just going to be the integration over the lambdas and so on. What was your question again now?
I mean, in the cases of Verrilli-Bohm theory, for example, to specify a measurement process, you're specifying an interaction Hamiltonian.
Yes.
It's part of a whole rich story about the dynamics of the wave function. So presumably all of that's implicit in the ontological model.
Yes.
Say what you mean by a measurement is going to require.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Here, I mean, this is, it's understood here that you have to provide exact mathematical prescription. What is the preparation? And you have to tell theoretically how you would prepare systems and so on. And the same thing with measurements. So then if you look in Bohm theory, you can theoretically understand how it fits into this scenario. Well, you can do the same thing for classical mechanics.
Just trying to understand then your indicator function of this last expression.
This one, or
yeah. Is this X the configuration space of everything, including the measurement operators?
Yes. This is everything.
It's not just X corresponding to the system. It's
no. It's everything. And that's also essential in Bohm theory. You're not going to get around without that. So if you require that you only use ontic variables of the system and have such a definite, such a distinction, then Bohm theory doesn't fit into this framework. You need to say everything is allowed. The only free variable I have is the Hamiltonian now.
Right.
This is sort of how I dictate the interaction between system and apparatus.
Right.
Why do you have a real part there?
This is the conjugate here. This is Hermitian. So in the case where this is not an eigenstate, this will be imaginary. So when this is an eigenstate now, then this will turn out to be always real valued and so on. But in the case where this method of local expectation values gives you a way to assign values to any operator for all times. So it's just a convenient way to do it. So you can sort of monitor the value of A as you're doing a measurement, and you see how it sort of, suppose here's your variable A. In the beginning, it can the value could be anything. And here you have the eigenvalues, for example. So what happens in the measurement is that it gets trapped in one of these eigenvalues. But before that, it's a continuum value variable. And also the same goes for the probability distribution of these guys. It's when you do a measurement, you actively influence the value of A. And then in the end, the probability distribution gets trapped into.
But when you say, maybe it's not an important point, but when you say local, you don't mean local in X, you mean local in time, is that right? Can you call it a local
expectation value?
Local expectation.
Oh, it's local in. Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Well, the reason I'm asking is that I'm not sure the status of that X in your expression, but if you just mean the thing that you would write in the Dirac notation as bra psi a hat ket psi, is that what you mean? Or do you mean that A is some sort of local operator at a given position, and I'm just confused by the notation, but if
I took that this is an operator.
Isn't that numerator the same as psi, you know, the Brouwer notation?
Yeah.
Isn't it just psi, A hat, psi? Is it the expectation?
So this A hat will be some function of A, and like that, so I'm just using it.
So you're imagining that A hat is expressed as some sort of differential operator in
sure.
Is that it?
Yes. Or this could also
so that you can give it a local meaning, guys.
Sure. I should really try to press on. We haven't.
That's what I'm asking.
But
there's no input. But then it's not defined in general, unless you have a specific way of writing it down.
Right.
You should take an arbitrary operator. You don't know what you mean by sandwiching.
So there's one important point here. You might question why I would have you say that the ontic variables is a pair here. But that follows from the this definition of ontological model. So at first I didn't understand that. I thought that I could just put whatever I liked here, and I could call that an ontic variable, just x and not psi. And, but that's not true, because according to this definition, the theory has to predict a well-defined indicator function. So that has to come out somehow. Now, if you look in Bohm theory, I'm not able to write down this indicator function without specifying my psi. So I really need my psi there. So if you look at the expression here, it takes the possible measurement I can do and this variable here. And in order to calculate that in Bohm theory, I need knowledge of psi. So that's why I need to put it among the ontic variables. If I don't, I don't get a well-defined indicator function. So
what would be wrong with squeezing psi in by assuming it's somehow part of the measurement? I mean, I know that's causally very weird because measurements are independent from the preparation, but.
Yeah. So now.
Does it break down because you'd like to say you want to reproduce the statistic? You have an additional condition you haven't stated, which is you're supposed to reproduce the quantum statistics. And you know with the quantum statistics, you can change the preparation procedure and keep the measurement procedure fixed and get the same statistics.
Yeah.
Would that force you to put psi in with the ontic variables?
Yeah. So that's one of the things. I'm still uncertain how, so sort of what type all these definitions are. This is one concern here. It would be very interesting if one has a definition which is actually completely tight. So what you're saying now, I had some division between variables here. I call that a measurement and I call that an ontic variable. So the only thing one should do is just to toy around with that. Could I put the wave function in the measurement? Not if you just if you formulate Bohm theory in this way, I say this is how I specify the measurement. Well, there's clearly no room in there. Then you have to develop your Bohm theory prime, you know, some different where somehow the wave function comes in here. I don't know how to think about it.
But doesn't I mean isn't the fact that the wave function has its own equation of motion?
Yeah.
Inimical to that idea.
That it's a measurement. Yeah.
It has an autonomous equation
yeah.
of motion, independent of everything in lambda apart from positions.
Yeah.
Right, because in classical physics, you could imagine a situation where you have a time-dependent Hamiltonian, which obeys an equation of motion. But that I don't think that would have any implications for whether you regard it. So.
Well, it's here that the specific suggestion is that psi can come into the measurement issue, the measurement variable. was just saying, like, it's hard to see how that's going to be compatible with a, sorry, yeah. Having to look at an equation of motion.
Do you have a suggestion on the answer? Your definition.
Well, given that you take lambda to describe not just the system, but the apparatus as well,
yeah,
just distinct from the way I do it, but given that you do that, it seems to me you don't need to also specify M on the right-hand side of the conditional, because lambda will already tell you exactly what sort of measurement you're doing. So there's no smuggling of psi into M, because all the information in M is already contained in lambda.
Yeah. But yeah, so this is another sort of shaky point here. I took lambda to be both system and apparatus now, and M just to be the interaction.
Oh, I see.
So, but then you may say, how do you implement that interaction? It has to be some physical system, right? Which I'm not excluding. This is the way I think. Well, if one wants to look at the probability as not logical model, this is how it has to look like. Because you need, in Bohm theory, you can't describe the theory in these terms unless you bring in both system and apparatus. That's how you understand this is the theory.
Is your conclusion that this ontological model scheme is too narrow? The Bohm theory doesn't really naturally fit into it, but nevertheless.
I think it does fit into it. If you just say, this is the measurement I'm doing, I'm representing it like that. It's nothing to do with the wave function. It has nothing to do with the ontic variables of the far office or anything like that.
But you just pointed out that the G of P or the
reaction
Hamilton
is
being left out.
Yeah, so that's not what I'm calling the far office then. So let's continue. One of the reasons, one main point of this seminar is to try to sort of bring out, do we have watertight definitions or not now? This is good discussion. But also, Nelson's mechanics is often stated that the wave function plays an epistemic role in that theory. But according to this definition, modulo possible. Two poles here, which you also have in Bohm theory. You have exactly the same ontic state space as in Bohm theory. It's the same thing. Nelson's mechanics is just Bohm theory with noise, basically. So the average trajectory in Nelson is the Bohmian trajectory. So it would be remarkable if you add noise to a theory and you get the wave function to play a probabilistic role. So according to these definitions, Nelson's mechanics is also has also the wave functions as part of its ontology. So now this is an interesting distinction between types of ontological models.
Sorry, before you.
Yeah.
So is your conclusion that you could not regard this the Bohmian theory as an ontological theory?
No.
If you didn't take the wave function to be real, if you took it to be
that's
the Hamiltonian.
My intuition was that yes, and
that's your intuition. But I mean, is this argument meant to enforce that intuition?
Yes, it's meant to enforce that intuition. If it's
can you repeat that sentence without making so many negatives? It was like double negative in there.
Okay. So it's not the case that I didn't know. So yes, if this definition works, and this part of this program is to make sharp definitions. So if this definition works, I would like it to enforce that in Bohm theory, the wave function is part of ontological variables. Yes, that's the case. Now, there's a lot of things you can fiddle around with. It was mentioned by you here that you could maybe put the wave function in the measurement. And I mean, one has to look at these things. Another possibility is that suppose you just postulate the wave function as an initial condition early in the universe, and then you say it's law-like. I don't know. This one has to think about these things. And the more loopholes, the worse the definition. But I was very skeptical to the definition in the beginning, as to Rob Speckens probably experienced in my email. But then I do see that it carries some weight here. So here's the first definition now, or classification. So remember now that a wave function induced probability distribution, rho psi, Lontic state space. So if it's true that this quantum, the fidelity, is zero for all pairs, for all distinct pairs, then it's psi ontic. So the claim then is that then the wave function is real. Now already here, what we've been discussing here, that already for ontological models you could presumably be forced to put the wave function among your ontic variables. Now,
but that's just saying that size, when the tube sizes are different, that the probability distributions are disjoint.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So the intuition here is that.
I assume you mean the complex projective. The projection on the
side
itself.
The ray itself.
Yeah, sure. So what? Exactly.
I mean, there's something to say, because you're assuming that big lambda is a measurable space, and that, I mean, it doesn't really strictly mean that the things at this point, because it depends on the properties of the measurable.
They're really only measurable functions.
Yeah, things like that.
The idea is probably it's something like this, that lambda splits into two variables, psi and omega, and the probability distribution looks something like that. So. And if you have two different psi's, so this is psi 1, outside 2 and psi 1, then there will be overlapping these two distributions. So if psi is part of my ontology, or if lambda it looks like that, then the probability distribution rho psi of lambda is just some rho. And these then are distributions of this type, are then trivially disjoint. So here the fear is the following, that if psi gets to be part of lambda, then we're all done. If it's a psi ontic theory, it's part of our ontology. But it could be maybe that psi doesn't become part of it anyway. we have some variable here which we cannot immediately identify as psi. Then this is the second test to tell if the wave function is ontic. What does this do to you? The argument here is that if the fidelity is always zero, let me sketch here the ontic state space. If the fidelity is zero, that means the probability distributions are always non-overlapping. So suppose here's the probability distribution for psi is over here, and here's the probability distribution for psi 2. This is psi 1 and psi 2. So this is the case where trivially you have this decomposition, and that is clear. It's a psi-ontic theory. In the case where it looks like this, it's not clear that you can decompose lambda into psi 1 and psi 2. Now, if the fidelity is always non-zero, sorry, if it's always zero, they're always non-overlapping, then there's a trivial map from lambda to my psi. If I'm here, I see that I'm belonging to the support of the probability distribution rho psi 1. So I can say, well, that establishes a map from the lambda to my to the wave function. And the same goes here. If I'm over here, I can say, well, clearly this is not the psi 1 state, but the psi 2 state. So is that clear? It wasn't particularly clear. Is it clear? Yeah. So
that's why they raised the question.
Yeah.
It's only an L2 function, and so it doesn't have a well-defined value at any given point. I mean, you can't necessarily define the supports in such a simple way. I mean, you could put a little bit of psi 2 inside psi 1 on a set of measure 0.
Well,
yeah. But I mean, I'm not serious here.
isn't that what you want? I mean, you want to take a slightly more sophisticated definition. Than
yes, exactly.
Because if there's only a set of measure zero where this thing goes wrong, that doesn't really count as.
No.
Yeah.
So, had you made the definition just that the product of the two distributions has to go to zero, then it would be subject to criticism.
Exactly.
Which is why you go with the fidelity definition.
Yeah, so an alternative definition is that rho psi 1 of lambda times rho psi 2 of lambda should be 0.
I mean,
lambda.
It's just a technical
relevance. Because the models that have been built didn't address, you know, would only have done rule out this one.
So you think it's relevant?
Yeah.
Why can't you redefine psi there if it's relevant? Why can't you
remember that for the quantum state, psi is defined as the equivalence class of states which differ only on sets of measure zero. So if you could say if there's a single element of that equivalence class which has no support in common with any single element of the other equivalence class, and make
it rigorous, so it's conditional. But can't I redefine psi in the first set? Suppose psi 1 was not, psi, you have the support of psi 1. Couldn't I redefine psi 1 to be 0 at one point within that place and define psi 2 to be 1 at that point? That won't change anything up to sets of measure 0.
Yeah.
But it'll change whether that point's in the support.
Yeah. So the support talk is heuristics. This one is the more serious bit. So the idea is that you don't want it to be possible to establish a mapping by any means from your ontic variables to psi. The right, how to say, a faithful mapping. I give you my lambda, and I say, well, then the probability distribution has to be this one, or the wave function has to be this one. I don't want that to happen. So if I'm here, for example, so this is a topological space, I can imagine that I'm extending my region a little bit, and I see, oh shit, the probability of being in this extended, region is non-zero now, and I can imagine that I have a one-parameter family of extending my region like that, and I see it's continuously growing. Well, then I will say, if I get a finite value there, then I'm psi 1. If it's 0, then I'm not psi 2. Because you see what I'm saying? There will be, if this is zero for all pairs, there will be a mapping I can establish from my onto state space to lambda. And I don't want that in the psi of this. If this model is psiontic, then that happens. If I want my wave function to be not part of my ontology, that I shouldn't be able to establish a mapping.
I'm sorry, I'm being slow. Could you explain that? I just haven't picked up the intuition.
I think I'm starting to explain things a little badly. So let me write down the second thing. So if the wave function happens to be part of my ontic variables, then it's an ontological entity. Then I have a second test here. If this is zero, so the second thing is that I just have some lambda. I cannot immediately establish a partition like that between omega and psi. But then by looking at probability distributions, that might aid me in establishing a mapping from this thing into what wave function I have. So if I have this property that fidelity is zero for all pairs, then there will exist a mapping from lambda to psi. So this will contain all the knowledge from psi. And then I would say, okay, then psi is part of my ontology still. It's just, if there's a mapping like that, I can, by change of variables, still partition it in this way. Because psi is reconstructible from lambda.
You're saying that if that fidelity is zero, that's a sufficient condition to be able to reconstruct psi?
Yes. That's the
case. That's a sufficient condition.
Yes.
Maybe positive
thoughts as well.
Which is that if complete specification of the ontic state is consistent with two different psis, then clearly psi has to be epistemic.
Yes. So let's write down a definition.
Yeah.
Well, so epistemic is not ontic. So that's an easy definition. These things are always taking much more time than I. The ontological model is psi epistemic. If it's not, I don't think. So now I have to say that this is, I think this is too cheap. Where am I now? So what does the negation of that definition say? It means there should exist a pair such as for just that pair. So I have a continuum, I have a non-denumerable set of states. Uncountable, and I found two of them, and it happens to have fidelity non-zero there. But then for all other states, it's exactly zero. And then, as an experimentalist, I'm saying, look, I will never ever be able to prepare exactly one state and exactly another state. So for all practical purposes, this is in fact just a psiontic theory. So. Here I think, so right now, to just have this definition of psi epistemic case when it's just a negation of the psi ontic theory allows you to construct very cheap psi epistemic theories, where the wave function would play a role in probability distribution. So I think it might be valuable to change, not to change the definition, but rather pointing out that this might be an issue with it's not a binary question. It's not that you have a psi epistemic theory or not. You could instead talk about psi epistemicity. So here's just one thing which I just write down on the top of my head. So here you can use the Haar measure or whatever to integrate all these things. Then if you construct it by brute force, psi epistemic theory, where you just have one pair of states for which the fidelity is non-zero, and for all the rest of the states it's zero, then still the epistemicity of that theory would be exactly zero, because those pairs of states that pair would have zero measure in the space of all states. So this variable here, epsilon, would go from 0 to 1. But it would be not a good idea to think of that, you know, here's the ontic theories, and here are the epistemic theories. Because if you say that the theory should be completely epistemic, having value 1, that means that the overlap or the fidelity should be equal to 1. But that means that they're completely parallel distributions. So, but for my purposes, for it might be interesting, this notion of epistemicity, when trying to prove theorems about if it's possible to have epistemic theories or not. For example, is it possible to have an epistemic? Is it possible to have a theory with non-zero epistemicity that reproduces the quantum statistics? So that's a non-trivial question, because if it's zero, then it's a psiontic theory. And then we're back at the Bohmian type models again. I've tried to think about different measures of epistemicity. This is the best natural I've come up with. So I'm already I've been talking for 1 hour and 5 minutes. So maybe I should just sketch in the end. Where's the?
You can pull down a floor if you want. There's some.
Is it here?
No, it's just.
Oh, okay. Okay. So let us now just look into what has been suggested as concrete epistemic models. And there's only one, basically, which is unpublished. So this is something Lucy and Rob Speckles and Jonathan Barrett, I don't know if you were involved or not, the list grows. So this was, I don't know how old it is, maybe two years, something like that. And it was an effort to get the model which is psi epistemic. Yeah. So, and.
Can I just ask one version?
Yeah.
I got a little lost. We were talking about the Bohm theory, but now you're talking much more generally.
Yes, we've gone more generally.
So,
yeah.
So, how did psi get into the story in this more general theory? Are you making a blanket assumption that there's always a psi and it always obeys the Schrodinger equation and it's always present in any theory that could provide a foundation to quantum mechanics? Any deeper theory?
Okay.
That seems like a very disputable.
So yeah, did I miss that? So the idea here is that the wave function should play a probabilistic role now. So the wave function.
But this could be the wave function that collapses according to the open-ended quantum prescription and so on.
Yeah, well, this wave function should be subject to some dynamics. So, but it should induce some probability distribution on the ontic state space. So that's how the wave function comes into this picture. Did that
answer your question? So we could just take the wave function as it is in the textbook quantum mechanics, and now you want to this epistemic interpretation.
I'd say we should just. It should be irrelevant for future predictions if you update the wave function according to some prescription, or if you just let it evolve entirely.
Irrelevant?
Yes. So the idea is that this should just be a probability distribution on some ontic state space. Yeah. And.
But should be divided. But the wave function is at a particular moment of time. So if you had collapsed it, then you use the collapse one. In that.
Well, I'm not sure. So one thing you might try to understand is, can I understand the state update rule in terms of this when it's just a passive updating of knowledge?
Yeah.
That's not obviously clear that you won't change future possible statistics and predictions when you do that. I mean, what I'm getting here is the following. In Bohm theory, the wave function plays a role of guiding the particles, right? And if you change it by updating it, you change the future predictions, maybe.
Right, I understand. So in the Bohm theory, it doesn't get. But I mean, we're trying to interpret that we're now in a much more general sense.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not more general. Maybe it excludes Bohm. I don't know. But, so what is psi that we're trying to interpret?
Yeah. Well, no. So
is it the psi of the Bohm theory? You know, is it the many worlds?
No.
Psi of the.
So, remember, I had a theory. I'm in a framework where I have probabilistic predictions and some preparations. Here, as part of possible preparations, I would put the psi.
Okay, so psi
somewhere.
Psi
so what I wrote here is just simply that thing here.
Okay.
And there might be many different preparations corresponding to the same psi or whatever. Right now, without thinking about updating and so on, we're just trying to get something which might fit the. See how it fits in according to these definitions. So the model developed by Jonathan Barrett and Lucien Hardy and Rob Speckens as well. In the first case, they just wanted this to be non-zero for some pairs, and that happens. But then when you took the fidelity, it turns out that became zero. So, because it was just a measure zero where you had this not equal. I'm not sure where to go now, right? Should I? Because I have so little time left.
Let's see if we'll get you the next 5 minutes about questions, and then we'll stop. Is that okay?
So let me. I always have. So let me just say the following. The idea behind this theory, which was developed. Was to assign outcomes to PVMs. If you look historically, that has already been suggested by von Frassen in 1973. So what I would have presented if I had more time was that this is actually excluded, this model,
because something called measurement order and contextuality, which I recently proved. The theory is designed to take care of ordinary contextuality, so that if you measure A together with a variable B, or measure A together with a other variable C, and you have the following commutation relations. Then it could be that the outcome of such a measurement is different from that. That's ordinary contextuality. The theory was constructed in order to be able to account for ordinary contextuality, so that you can have different outcomes depending what measurement context you do. But the theory was not designed to take into account a different context, namely what order you measure an operator. So here I'm inventing some notation. This is where you measure A, you record the outcome, and then you measure B. This is the outcome where you first measure B, you record the outcome, and then measure A. Now, in this, so here, A and B are commuting, so it's a non-trivial thing. So in addition, not just specifying the context, I'm measuring A with B. There's a different context, second context, which could be which order you're measuring them. And you can prove that any theory that reproduces the quantum statistics can give different outcomes like that, that I'm calling it, that the theory is measurement ordering contextual. So I could just end maybe by sketching a simple proof of that, then we just stop. So I plan to, there will be another hour, to get into the historical context of this model, epistemic model, which was suggested. So it looks, it's identical in fact, except to some details, to a model by von Frassen in 1973. But so I'm just going to state why the model doesn't work. Look at the notation now. Here, this is the outcome when I'm measuring A before B. This is the outcome when I measure B before A. So first consider the following scenario. I'm measuring A, and I'm waiting perhaps a year or whatever. And then I flip a coin, and I'm deciding if I'm supposed to measure B or C. Suppose I measure A, and immediately record the outcome. Then, after an arbitrary long time, I decide and here by coin flipping or something, I can, so it's sort of a free choice. Just want to insert something here. So it's not predictable what I'm going to do. So I flip a coin and then I decide decide to measure B or C. So here, that is very reasonable to assume that if I now measure A before B, let me insert a lambda here as well. Yeah.
then it's very reasonable that if I'm measuring those after I measured A and also recorded the outcome of A, then the outcome has to be the same. Because how could something I'm doing in the future change the past? So this is sort of excluding retrocausal or conspiratorial scenarios. So this is a reasonable assumption. Then I'm going to assume measurement ordering non-contextuality, and I'm going to get the contradiction that I need. In this context, it means that the outcome of A, if I measure it after A, has to be equal to, has to be the same outcome if I measure D before. And the same thing goes for AC. And now the proof is very simple of measurement order and contextuality, or establishing a contradiction in quantum theory. So.
But these are not the quantum.
What?
Over the way to the end.
Go ahead.
Suppose now I start with the one when I measure B before A. Then, since I'm assuming measurement ordering non-contextuality, I can just switch it. And now, since I'm assuming the reasonable condition here, I can just switch it to C here. Because that I can assume is carried out a long time after. And now, again, measurement ordering non-contextuality, I can put C in front of it. But what I'm proving now is that not only is it independent of context, when the context is part of the future, it's also independent if I'm actually doing the measurement before. So it's completely non-contextual theory. So and this, you cannot reproduce quantum statistics with it if it's completely non-contextual. So this gives absurdity, and you have to give up one of the assumptions here. The most natural one to give up is measurement ordering non-contextuality. This assumption here would take you into retrocausal scenarios and conspiratorial theories. So this property I first discovered in Bohm theory, and I tried to prove it in different ways. I failed, and then, but it was when I was looking at these epistemic theories when I saw the proof how to do it. So that's basically it. So this is a new form of contextuality, and I expect that in quantum theory there will be many, many different more types of contextuality present. But the interesting thing with this thing, with this measurement ordering contextuality, is that it rules models, rules Van Prassen's 73 model, and also the Barrett Hardy Speckens model. So it's a bit tougher to construct epistemic models because of this. I also think any model that just assigns outcomes to measurement, and you take measurement as a primitive notion, that's going to be very, very, it's in danger of being excluded by some form of contextuality. Contextuality is basically this. Suppose you have many different ways of implementing the same measurement. Contextuality then says that you can get different outcomes depending on what type, how you implement the measurement. So unless you, in your theory, actually describes how you implement the measurement, you're going to run in the danger of not being able to explain some kind of contextuality. So, for example, in von Krasen's Barrett, Beckens, Hardy model, what was excluded there was not taken into account is that the outcome could depend on the measurement ordering context. And it was just designed to take into account the ordinary contextuality due to Bell and Koshin and Speck and so on. I think I am there. Unfortunately, I wait too little time. Thank you.
It would be very helpful to me if you could give me the example that you saw in the bone theory.
Sure. That was just an EPR scenario. So I had some computer code. So you have here, you can do the measurement A, for example, here. And here you do measurement along B angle here. And suppose now, hopefully this will be a good picture. I can do the measurement up here, B measurement, and the A measurement here in this way, or I can do the measurement like that, or like that in a different order. And here's also some. Absolute. Well, so in bone theory, I have an absolute simultaneity, right? So I'm just saying, suppose this is the measurement order. Could I get a different outcome of A if I first measure B and then A, or if I first measure A and then B? And then you can just calculate that in bone theory with a simple model due to Anthony.
And the outcomes changes.
The outcome changes, yeah.
Did it change also if you kept A just fixed in time and just had B moved up and down?
Yeah. So in bone theory, there would be. So did I wipe that out? If I change just these things, you see you have profiles, these coupling constants. You can have any type of profile. So in bone theory, you have sort of a. It's very rich of contextual. If I had one profile and I changed the profile a bit, could you get a different outcome? Yes. So, and this is just sort of more enforcing the idea that you're not measuring anything in bone theory. You're just, performing some experiment. And then the measurement apparatus forces a certain outcome. It's more like throwing dice in bone theory. If I have two different kind of floors, can I get different outcomes? Yes.
But if they happen to be along the same axis, then that doesn't happen. Then you get the perfect correlations.
Yes, that has to be, yeah, exactly. If I have a perfect correlation, that has to be excluded, yes.
You get the perfect correlation, but it still can change as to whether you get both pointing up or both pointing down.
Well, if I record one for, I have to think now. Yeah. Yeah, probably that's possible. I didn't think about that. As long as I get perfect correlations, that should be possible, right?
So, as I've said before, I really like the measuring ordering textuality, but I'm not sure if it's right to say that this rules out the model. I think what's more appropriate to say that the model as it stands is incomplete. And it's an open question as to whether it could be completed in a way incorporates measurement ordering contextuality.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so it depends what you mean by the model. But the one which is written down, where you have the outcome specified, that model is ruled out. But then again, I mean, you have to take this into account.
So the originally, I mean, it was written down and really only, it was incomplete in the sense that it only specified outcomes for maximal observables.
Yes.
So non-degenerate observables. So then it's a question of, well, how do you want to specify outcomes for degenerate observables? One way to do it would just be choose your favorite maximal observable and coarse grain over that one. But you don't have to choose that way of assigning outcomes to non-degenerate observables. So the open question is there some scheme by which you could assign outcomes that would be measurement ordering contextual?
Yeah, so von Fraassen's model is exactly so von Fraassen said, he was faced with contextuality, ordinary quantum mechanics, and then he said, I'm going to change the outcome rules now. So he said, I'm going to assign values to maximal observables, that is non-degenerate observables. Then I'm going to define a way how to attach values to degenerate observables, given the value for the maximal observable. His scheme of doing that fails. You can't do that. And any scheme that just assigns values to maximal observables and then derive values for degenerate observables will fail, because it lacks the context of measurement ordering. So all the schemes where you say that, okay, I have a maximal observable, and then I have the value of that, and then I'm going to produce values for all the degenerate observables compatible with that maximal observables. Those will fail. So I think you're back at attaching values to any degenerate observable, and in effect, to attach values given a certain measurement procedure. You need to specify more how you measuring things, especially the measurement ordering. Yeah. I think also I will be able to prove, if I think more about it, that any hidden variable theory has to be like Bohm theory, that the outcome of a measurement is really created by a measurement of our outputs. So I like to use the analogy of a dice, of a die. It's completely incoherent to say that I'm measuring what side the die has when I'm throwing it. And measurements in Bohm theory is like that. When I'm measuring the energy, I'm not measuring anything. When I'm doing the measurement, I'm creating the outcome. It's both system and apparatus that creates the outcome. Exactly in the same way I'm throwing the die, it's the floor that successively takes away kinetic energy of the die, and then one side lands on top. If I have two different floors, two different measurement apparatuses here, can I get different outcomes? Yes. It's sort of a triviality. In Bohm theory, if I implement the measurement in two different ways, can I get two different outcomes? Yes, because it's not really that I'm looking at some property, it's the measurement device that actually creates the outcome together with the system. Von Fraassen's model was interesting because it was designed to actually not be like that. It was designed to be that when I'm measuring A with B or A with C, I'm looking at two different properties. So it would sort of be some kind of ontological contextuality that I am revealing a value that was pre-existing in the system, and the apparatus didn't change anything. It just the measurement revealed that value, but I'm looking at different values, and that is excluded because of this measurement or in contextuality. I cannot think of quantum measurements like that.
I think maybe we should anyway. So Hans is still around.
Sure. So let's thank Hans for